This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us to discuss and analyze the week's biggest news stories and the key developments taking place in Cincinnati and the tri-state are City Hall reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Sharon Coolidge, WCPO.com editor-in-chief Mike Cannon, and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can be part of our discussion at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Sharon, Mike, and Howard, good to see everybody this afternoon.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, Sherry, the Metropolitan Sewer District, its spending practices are under scrutiny right now, and it's to the tune of, what, about $680 million?
Definitely. The Inquirer last November learned that the FBI was taking a look at some things over at MSD. Not a lot of details. That's typically how the FBI works. And Dan Horn and I just set out to try and figure out what they were really looking at. We made a giant public records request, and the stories you're seeing these days are what we're seeing in records that are coming out of City Hall.
So what are we finding out so far?
I think one of the big things that we found right away was there was spending authority for one person. So little oversight. And we're talking about money to the tune of $680 million. I mean, it was an incredible amount of money when we added it all up.
And that one person was?
The MSD director, Tony Parrott.
Right.
And now he's no longer here. He's now in Louisville, correct?
He is. He left for a new job.
How long has this been going on that you can tell from these records, Sherry?
Well, the spending authority change occurred in 2007. Dan and I, to make things a little bit more manageable, have looked at the last couple years and sometimes back 10 years. And we're looking at contracting and who's getting the money and where the money's going.
The story today that you and Dan had, I thought was most fascinating about the Sam Malone arrangement. Tell us a little bit about that. What was in the paper today online?
Well, that was really, you know, that was something that came out of like our bigger look at things.
Right.
And we decided that this one check that we discovered in like line items of one big spreadsheet that we have was worth taking a look at because it was just an oddity. Amended contracts, a manual check, things, emails that suggest, like contracts that don't mention Sam Malone, emails that suggest it is for him. And so the story was really designed to look at this $55,000.
So Sam Malone was a former city councilman and worked as a contractor for MSD, correct?
Yes.
Now,
but he was working for Bricker and Eckler, the Columbus
law firm.
Right.
Yes. So he was a subcontractor, which the Bricker and Eckler contract expressly forbid, and Dan and I aren't lawyers, but that paragraph jumped right out at us. It was clear as day.
Okay.
Subcontractors have to be approved.
One of the things that I just found fascinating about it was that, first of all, his billing, his line item on what he said he did was just so incredibly vague. And then on top of that, even after they gave him the $55,000, he kept coming back and saying, here's more invoices, and trying to meet with people. And it was just like this sort of never-ending cycle.
And, you know, when you look at their invoices and you can see what work they did, you know, it says work for responsible bidder. That was such a huge issue in the city and the county for several months. And we're looking at this and we're like, that went away. And it clicked with us that he was billing for it after everything had been done. And
After it was a non-issue. I mean, it was no longer an issue.
Correct.
And I think it was a case of he was charging like $62.50 if you broke it down for per email, per phone call, which a lot of people, if you think about it, you go, what?
That's been a big takeaway. Honestly, when people talk to me about the story, that is a number they remember. And then today, you know, we're doing a little bit of math, and I'm like, that's 4 months' work. Now, wait a second. That's almost $500 a day.
And in total, it was a whole lot of money.
Yes. $331,000 altogether.
Yeah.
What kind of reaction, Sharon, have you gotten to the story from the public?
I was presently surprised because sometimes, so first of all, MSD is a very important issue at the newspaper because of sewer rates. Our sewer rates are going up to pay for this huge upgrade to keep our water clean, and it hurts people in their pocketbooks. And we hear about sewer bills, but that's why spending at MSD is so important. And then these, but you never know what kind of traction you're going to get on a story where you're talking about sewers. But this has been such a pleasant surprise where the community is like, we want you to look. We want you to go through public records. I'm sure, Mike, I'm sure you guys are hearing that.
Like, oh, yeah, for sure.
I think people are realizing now that these things exist and can be examined and looked at, and they want it.
Well, you know that, I mean, you can get people's attention if you're talking about the potential of wasting a whole lot of taxpayers' dollars, no matter what it's being wasted on.
And I think that's what we're looking at here. Today is not the last story we're going to write about this.
Yeah.
The situation is not still going on, though. The current administration is taking steps on this, right?
Dan and I are looking at everything. A lot of things have changed at City Hall. Procurement practices are being cleaned up, tightened. You can see that there's a lot of oversight. But just this week, we learned that the audit division, the independent oversight's not there anymore. And that's going on right now. So I don't think that we're just dismissing it as something that was in the past. We're looking at everything that's happening right now, too.
Do you know where the FBI investigation stands at this point?
I don't. I wish I did.
Yeah.
Sure, I wish I did. Several months I know of from people I've talked to.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what they're doing right this second.
Well, yeah, they don't talk.
Yeah, no, they don't.
Funny how that works.
But the FBI investigation is going on. Do we know for sure, Sharon, if there's anything criminal going on, or is that still to be determined?
Dan and I are only going through the records and writing what we see. Whether there was criminal intent here or criminal behavior, we're going to let the authorities decide. And we're just writing down the facts as we see them.
Now, MSD is owned by Hamilton County. It's operated by the city. Do I have the order correct?
There's some nuances there with things the city owns, but that's the general overview of it.
So I guess the point I'm getting at, Sharon,
city
is
owns
what
the
is
assets?
Yeah. What is each side saying about this?
You know, the county is really calling for more oversight. So you see, it's a continuing war over what's going on at the sewer district. Just this week, I had an opportunity to look at all of the correspondence between the city and the county. It was 1,000 pages over about a year and a half of back and forth, and the rhetoric and the arguing. And I just, it's ramping up instead of dying down. And I don't see an easy path in this relationship.
Now, didn't they do previous audits of MSD?
Well, there was a state audit, but it was more of a routine one. I've learned a lot about auditing. The state, you know, they take a look at a lot of spending, and they want to know, are you following the rules? Or did you put these items in the right one? Do these numbers kind of, you know, gel? They're not doing deep dives. I mean, how could they possibly do that? If you look at all of the spending authorities throughout the state and just in communities, we're talking about vocational schools and not just city and county governments. It's many layers. So there was some things found, but definitely not to the level, I think, that was looked at by what Dan and I are doing.
If you have any questions about MSD, give us a call, 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org.
Well, that's a fact. I mean, the state auditor is saying he's going to take another look at this now, isn't he?
He did. I mean, I was surprised.
But there's only so, like you point out, I mean, you can only go so deep into this thing. You know, I mean, obviously the FBI can go anywhere they want.
And farther than we can, because they can look at things like finances.
Exactly.
All we have are public records, which fortunately in this state are very helpful and fairly generous.
Yes, and you've done an excellent job of getting a hold of them. But you're going to have to keep doing that to keep this.
And we are going to keep doing that. It's a mission that the Inquirer feels is very important, and they're giving us leeway to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, like, we just grapple with what we're looking at, because I want to go back through $680 million of spending. I want to see where every single dollar went. I'm not sure that's something I have the time to do or the knowledge to do.
Howard, you've been covering politics and government for a long time now.
Yes.
Wouldn't you find some people might look at this and say, well, this is just business as usual. What's different about this?
Well, yeah, I mean, there is a cynical view about government, obviously, and government and politicians. But when you do these kind of stories like Sharon and Dan are doing, and you bring to light what appears to be some very very extreme cases of a waste of government money, people are going to sit up and take notice of this.
And, you know, one story's really led to another. We've had suggestions to look at other things. Things we've seen in the records have taken us in different directions than we thought they would, because the first records request wasn't based on anything other than educated guesses of things that we should be taking a look at.
Well, I know, you know, I mean, this is a very complex story, and, you know, you and Dan are doing a great job with the thing, but you are going into a very deep hole. It's a tough story. It's not easy, and it's going to take a long time.
So it sounds like it's like peeling the layers off of an onion then.
It is, but honestly, it's worth it.
Yeah.
Because these big, huge billion-dollar sewer projects are not going away.
Oh, yeah.
And that means we can't go away, because that's our job, is to be watchdogs of the community.
I think that's an example of a great investigation, is one story leads to another, and each one is just peeling back the layers of the onion, and you're finding more and more things that you're like, wow, this is really interesting. I can't believe this is happening or that's happening. And then people in the community or sources feed you more and more and more. You can kind of just keep the ball rolling.
We have had a question from Bill in Mount Airy. He says, if MSD goes to the county, I guess he means county control, what oversight will there be?
Well, when you take a look at how decoupling MSD is going to be a massive task, and if it comes to that, take many, many years. But to me, that's actually one government that you're looking at instead of two. So, but there's a lot of monitoring in practice at the county. They have, you know, contractors themselves to do it. They have an actual position that's the MSD monitor. When they started to have a lot of questions in, I think, 2010, they decided to put someone over there, and that's been a source of much tension.
Don't you think, I mean, one of the arguments between the city and the county is, you know, how do we resolve this, you know, with this contract coming due in 2018? It's either going to be mediation or take it to a judge to figure out, okay, who's going to run this thing?
We're definitely headed to court on this one.
Yeah.
They Chris Munzel, the president of the commissioners, and John Cranley, our mayor, came into editorial board. It couldn't have been more clear. We're going to court on this. And they're using the model of the city pension. That was so political. Those decisions were so difficult that it really was a historic decision in the city to put everything in the court's hands. And I think they're looking at that as the model to move it.
And the mayor wants to go to the same judge.
I feel like, because that judge is over the consent decree,
that
I'm a little fuzzy on that right now.
Okay.
But it will be the same judge.
Yeah. All right.
We will continue our conversation about the week's big news stories, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us with a look at the news of the week from Cincinnati and the Tri-State, our City Hall reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Sharon Coolidge, WCPO.com editor-in-chief Mike Cannon, and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And I should point out, too, that if you want to read more about the Inquirer's coverage about MSD, you can find that at Cincinnati.com.
Yes.
Mike, WCPO.com, you've been following the tragic death of local cyclist Michael Prater, who was hit and killed by a motorist, 34-year-old Melinda Woodall. Her case is making its way through the legal system right now. Where do things stand with that?
Well, I haven't followed every single step of the way, so I'm not exactly sure where she currently stands in the legal process.
But she was indicted this week, correct?
She was indicted, and I'm not sure what the next steps are.
I think probably to set a trial date or you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Or a plea deal.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what the timeline is on that, but they'll start to, the wheels of justice are starting to turn on that process. But.
Yeah. How's the local biking community reacted to this story?
That was a huge reaction to it. I mean, I'm a runner. I'm not a cyclist, but, you know, those communities overlap quite a bit. And I know my Facebook feed was just lit up with people who were doing this ghost ride over the weekend that they all sort of rode in silence to remember Michael Prater. People in that type of community, they're very close-knit. Everyone knows each other. And they really pull together when these types of things happen. And I think it's for two reasons. Number one, there's just an enormous sort of kinship and brotherhood in those types of endurance athletes. When, you know, if you see someone who does what you do, you kind of connect with them. And there's also that sense that that could have been me. I mean, I'm out there on the roads running early, and I don't always wear lights as much as I should. And, you know, sometimes I'm in the bike lane, sometimes I'm in the road. You know, that could be me pretty easily. And so it kind of makes your wheels turn a little bit and makes you connect even more with that story or with that individual.
I agree with that. And we had the runner who was hit and killed mm-hmm. as well. And it just seems like there's been a series of them, of people who were doing what they were supposed to be doing.
Yeah, the runner was on the sidewalk.
Right.
I mean, there's nothing she could really have done differently besides not be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
So strong reaction from the biking community. Do you think that there's some push, too, for completing more bike paths, more bike trails?
Oh, yeah. There definitely is a big push in this community for more and better. I mean, there's the whole issue with the safety of the bike lanes and how they're used. There's the push for more trails and bike paths, aside from the ones that are the bike lanes that run along the side of the road, so that people have ways to either commute or do their recreation where you're not right next to a car. Anytime you're right next to a car, that just increases the danger, especially now when you have so many people who are high on heroin driving around and you just can't predict what they're going to do.
You can see the passion with the Central Park bike path.
Oh, yeah.
People love that, and they just...
The push for the bike paths, I mean, the commuter aspect of it, I think, is key.
Oh, yeah.
To getting these things done, because they, you know, recreational biking is great and, you know, going from, you know, point A to point B, but, you know, using bike paths to get to work in the morning, is something that is a practical benefit to everybody.
Right. Yeah. I think the whole world's moving in that direction
right. Of
wanting to have that for your livable communities.
But we got to find the money, to be able to do that.
Yeah, and you have to have connectivity. That's the key. And like right now, we have a lot of great bike paths and trails
that are
fantastic, but you can only go so far with them. So, in the lead up to the city parks levy last November, we sent a team of reporter and photographer Lisa Bernard Kuhn and our photographer Emily Maxwell out to Colorado, because one of the places the city kept pointing to in terms of this is what we want to be when we grow up in terms of parks and recreation was Denver. And so we went and looked at the sort of bike network that's there in Denver and in Boulder, and an enormous number of people use that to commute into work, a much, mm-hmm. much higher percentage than actually commute using a bike or bike trails here. It's a very low number here.
Yeah.
And the key is that connectivity. And all along, wherever that bike trail ran, there's restaurants and shops that are catering specifically to those people, because that's how they get to and from work. And also, that's where they go for recreation, too. So it has this twofold effect in building community and in making sure people are safe.
So there's a push on, we're talking about bike trails. I think there's also a push on to connect the bike trails as they get completed in this area. And I would have to think that this would, a tragedy like this would make that need all the more apparent.
Yeah, I mean, you would think so, and you would hope so. I mean, it doesn't do any good if you take a bike trail and you get to the outskirts of downtown, and then after that, you're driving on main roads shoulder to shoulder with a car that's mirrors going to clip you. That isn't going to make it easy for you to get around. Or say you can get to work safely on a bike, but then when we're at work, sometimes you got to go run to CVS or go pick something up. If you can't safely do that, then you still need a car to be able to get around. So you have to be able to have lots of interconnected networks that you can get different places, different times of day, and do it safely.
We had a caller who asked if there was a plea deal for the woman who hit the cyclist. What's your sense? Would this cause a lot of outrage in the community, in the biking community in particular? And
I think it probably depends upon what the deal is.
Yeah.
I think people will have different reactions based on what the deal is.
Yeah,
and I feel like people will be calling for punishment for sure. I get that sense in comments that we're seeing on the stories. But additionally, I mean, stories like this open up where people are talking about the need for more treatment in this community. You don't have just one side. You don't see right. when we have all these crimes and there's many, many, many heroin accidents. And you do see, you know, the tragedy and people want to see these go to court. But one of the things about this community is what we're going to do about the problem. And people understand that. And that's a big issue right now, our underlying how we're going to deal with all of this. Right. And so it highlights that, too.
Yeah, because, I mean, these addictions lead to incidents like this.
Absolutely.
Which were, you know, not intended, not, you know, planned out, not, you know, cold-blooded murder, but an accident that was caused by a person who had an addiction, period.
And Mike, the WCPO.com had an editorial about the heroin issue. Tell us about that. I mean, you took a position on this.
Yeah, so we have an editorial board at WCPO where we, just like the newspaper has, we form an opinion that's the opinion of the station. In addition to our sort of regular editorial board, we've built a sort of panel of people who are experts on the topic of heroin. I think we're up to like 12 different people from all facets, because heroin is a disease that touches all different areas of our community. And one of the first things that group of experts who are all across our community, both geographically and in terms of what topics they touch or cover, they said, you know, heroin needs to be treated as a disease. And if heroin were treated as a disease, it would totally change the approach that you take in terms of solving that problem. And so the more we started talking about it, the more we felt like when we began our sort of editorial campaign on heroin, that's where we need to start, is that heroin is a disease. Because there's a lot of people who, I mean, when we posted our editorial on our Facebook page, there were something like 480 comments. And it was split 50-50, I would say, in terms of people saying it is a disease or it's not a disease. And the argument is, well, you know,
some people say it's a choice.
Some people say it's a choice. You chose to take heroin and then you became addicted. And, I sort of look at that as like, well, you chose to light up a cigarette and ultimately ended up with heart disease. That doesn't mean we wouldn't say, you know what, we're not going to put AEDs in government buildings because it's a choice you made. Yeah. We're not going to revive this person because of the choice they made.
Right.
You're still going to try to save that person's life, whether it's with an AED or whether it's with Narcan.
Well, and speaking of Narcan, Mike, Kroger made an announcement today that it was going to start offering naloxone, which is Narcan. I think it's the generic version of it. They're going to start offering that over the counter. How big a move is that?
It's really big. Our crime and justice reporter, Taylor Merfendereski, reported a few weeks ago about Narcan and its availability. And one of the challenges was the over-the-counter just wasn't available in a lot of places. So if people were looking for it, it was very difficult to find. And Kroger is one of the biggest pharmacies, if not the biggest pharmacies in this region. So that's going to be a game changer. And it'll also will pressure other pharmacies to step up to the table and make sure that this drug is available, because you can't get someone off heroin and end that addiction if they're dead.
Yeah, I mean, in the past, it's been basically medical professionals and law enforcement people who've had access to that, to be able to use it on a person who is, you know, ODing on heroin.
And they haven't even had enough of it. I mean, you hear a lot of that at City Hall, how much they need it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a common feeling in our community at this point that so many people know somebody affected by it that you would say, no, I can't even believe that, you know, someone I know is affected by this, whether it's somebody's child or distant relatives, because it's affecting our inner core and our suburban area. And Kroger's everywhere. So this was a big move this morning.
Yes.
I think CVS has also said they're going to offer it over the counter as well.
That's
so
true.
That expands the availability greatly. Prior to this, Mike, I think I saw in one of the stories on CPO.com, it was just maybe like a few dozen pharmacies had it across the state.
It was very, very small, and so it made it difficult to get. And if you're a loved one of someone who is suffering from heroin addiction, you're trying to do anything you possibly can to keep that person alive. And if here's this tool that could help you keep a loved one alive and you can't find it, can you imagine the heartbreak, especially if something bad were to happen and you could have had this that would have prevented that? So I think it's just a great and important move and a big step in terms of keeping people alive. And then that allows – it's like buying time to then try to get them back to the point where they can function in normal society again, and the addiction isn't – have total control over their lives.
Yeah. Any idea how much this will cost?
You know, I don't know. I don't know if anyone else has seen that today.
Not really, no.
No, that's a very good question, actually.
It is a good question. But, you know, you're exactly right. I mean, it's a stopgap thing to give time to get that person help, get that person treatment, get that person, you know, off of this addiction, which can be done.
Yeah, we've had great conversations, both through the editorial board that we've built, and also through other meetings that I've had with Chief Tom Sinan with the Newtown PD, who's a very, very strong voice when it comes to the heroin addiction. And that's what he keeps saying over and over again is, you know, some people don't particularly want, don't think that law enforcement should be carrying Narcan or things like that. And
why would they feel that way, Mike?
They just feel like it's enabling.
Enabling, okay.
You know, his point is, I can't save them. I can't help that person if I can't keep them alive.
Right.
There's just no possible way. And, you know, he feels like it's law enforcement and any first responder's responsibility to save people. I mean, that's why first responders got into the job and the career and the vocation that they did, is to save people's lives.
Save people's lives and then try to turn them around.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And our producer, Pete Reitmeier, looked up some information. He says he's not exactly sure, but he found one reference to one dose back in November in the state of Ohio cost $42. So that's roughly what it is. 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. And Mike, what else have you been working on over at WCPO.com?
So we had a big three-part series that we published this week on sort of the state of Catholic schools in the Diocese of Cincinnati. And it was a really interesting look because there's almost sort of like three sections of schools, and how they're doing is varies wildly depending upon where you are and what school you're at. But one of the things I found most interesting was the sort of inner city, the real urban core here, despite the fact that there are many fewer Catholics living here than there were, say, 20 years ago, there actually are more students in Catholic school now than there were 10 years ago, and most of them aren't Catholics. They have all these voucher programs and scholarship programs that are allowing poor inner city students to get a Catholic school education. It was fascinating.
So what do you think are some other reasons that the Catholic education is thriving in this area?
Well, it's not thriving everywhere, and there are pockets of places where it's not doing –
Is it doing better in the Catholics, suburbs maybe?
So the far-out suburbs, it tends to be doing a lot better. The places where you're seeing lots of growth, like, you know, Butler and Warren counties, they in some cases are building more classroom space because of how much demand there is. And in a lot of cases, I think it you have to look at and follow the migration and the pattern of where people move and how people you know, operate. If you look at some of the changes in some of the places on the west side in terms of who lives there and when they live there and, you know, how old they are. And so when you look at the ages of people who are going to have kids, a lot of people have moved further out into the suburbs. And so those are the places now that have a high demand for Catholic school education. And they're in some places in the west side, they've actually merged and closed schools because there's just not enough students anymore. You'll have schools that will have, you know, 200 total students or 150 total students, and they're trying to see if they are still a viable option.
Yeah, it's almost the same thing that's happened in politics in Hamilton County. The Republicans on the west side have all moved out, you know, into Butler and Warren County. You know, so I mean, the same thing happens with Catholic families.
Well, and people feel very passionate here. Like, even if your school is struggling with attendance, people still want their parish to have it. They want that option for their children.
Yeah.
It's such a passion topic in this community.
Mike, you were mentioning that a lot of the students are there through vouchers and things like that. So did you look at the actual percentage of students who are in Catholic education who happen to be Catholic?
So in those suburbs that are further out, it's very high. Most of them are Catholic. I think it was like 98% or something like that. And in fact, in like the Butler and Warren area and those types of suburbs, most of them are going to the Catholic school that is actually in their parish. A huge chunk of them are. But when you look at the sort of inner city, there's more non-Catholics than there are Catholics. I don't have the percentage off the top of my head, but it's pretty high.
Mm-hmm. And Sharon, there were some promotions at the Cincinnati Police Department this week. What happened there? What did those entail?
Well, we had some surprise promotions.
It was nine total, wasn't it?
Yes. And we saw the second female assistant chief ever. We saw a promotion there, and really with the solidifying of the top staff as we get into the spring season and they're trying to reduce crime. And that left some room in the captain ranks, and we saw a lot of diversity there. And that's a big topic in City Hall, to make sure our police department is diverse and who's leading it, so it mirrors our community.
So why were these a surprise?
I don't think I saw them coming this week, that's all.
they do that. Did you get an impression of what the rank and file think, the FOP and the... of these appointments?
Well, I you didn't hear a lot when they were announced inside right. City Hall, but I saw a post on that suggested there's some animosity within the police department. I haven't had a chance to get a really good look at that, but I'm not sure everyone is happy about it.
Okay.
You think this is a sign of what the new chief, where he intends to take the department, what direction he intends to head it in?
Well, I think before he even came, the City Hall administration and the chief himself talked about the importance of diversity, and I think that they're living up to their promise.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney, and my guest this afternoon, City Hall reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Sharon Coolidge, WCPO.com editor-in-chief Mike Cannon, and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson, as we discuss the news stories of the week. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Jess in Clifton joins us now. Good afternoon, Jess.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
Go ahead.
So my question's kind of, I guess, directed at Sherry. There's a Cincinnati Politics Forum on Facebook that is, I guess, run by the Inquirer. I don't know what word I'm looking for that, but it's so divisive and so ugly, and the people all really just blow up our city politics. And I feel like it seems that online format, it allows more articles like that to be written within the paper. So I'm just wondering how much likes and how much comments and how much divisiveness on that forum allows more articles that way to be put on your hard copy paper.
Well, I don't think so. If you're speaking of the Greater Cincinnati Politics page, we had a politics blog at the Inquirer, and we've kind of moved it to as we changed to social media. It's changed to the Facebook page. And honestly, we treat it like free speech. We want to hear what people have to say. You're absolutely right. There's a lot of divisiveness on it, and it sometimes turns ugly. And we try and keep it in check a little bit, but it really is. The Inquirer sees it as a free speech issue, and we want to hear what people are saying.
Free speech can be messy.
I understand that. And in their defense, they do occasionally, Carl Weiser or Cindy Andrews or someone will put up something saying, look, let's discuss these issues, but let's be civil about it. Let's not call each other names. Let's not, do that sort of thing. But it's hard to control.
It is hard to control.
Once you put it up there and people take off on some issue and start going back and forth and back and forth, it's very hard to control. But as I say, they do try to tell people, keep this a civil conversation. Let's talk about the issues. We can disagree, but we don't have to do name calling.
And I'm apt to remind people of that, too, as I get called names on occasion. At the same time, it has shown us that people want a forum to talk about what's going on in our community, and it's not enough to just be comments on a story where they tend to be like an individual comment of what you're thinking. They want to engage, and some issues are more divisive than others. And I learn things from them. I've gotten some MSD tips in the comments when I post my stories on that. And
you can do that.
I was going to ask you, how much of this drives what you report later on? You learn new things.
you can always pick up things, you know, from comments from readers and that sort of thing. I mean, that's that. I used to do it when I was at the Enquirer. I do it here. You know, that's one of the things that is a valuable asset.
It's a communication. It's a communication right. form. The same as if you walked into a mall, there's going to be inappropriate and appropriate conversations right. going on at any point in time. And you, as a member of the media and a journalist, can get information that can help inform your reporting, just yeah. the same as there's a whole lot of noise there that you just want to turn away from. And, you know, I like to look at those types of forums and hope that people in the forum will try to self-regulate. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the key things, I mean, that's a Facebook forum. That's great because at least people have to use their Facebook account versus yeah, there's right. so many other places where people can make anonymous comments.
Sure.
And when people have to have, you know, their name attached in some way, at least it gives a little bit of pause to some people sometimes.
You'd
other people
so.
Don't care at all and they post whatever.
Well,
but still, so I think it helps bring the level slightly better.
How much of this kind of thing do you see at CPO.com?
Well, I mean, our Facebook page, it's quite a bit. And I mean, in my previous life, you know, I was a newspaper editor and, you know, we would see it there too. I mean, you just, you know, certain topics are going to go nowhere good. The conversation is not going to be relevant to what the topic is. And I think you have to watch and think about, like, is it even worth posting this to such and such Facebook page or this group? Because we know the conversation isn't going to be valid. It's not going to be worth having. The conversation isn't going to be about the topic that we're posting on. It's going to be yeah. in left field.
I think it's a good idea that you know, the Enquirer editors every once in a while will say, hey, look, let's keep this to Ohio and Kentucky and Indiana, or, you know, our local area. Let's talk about the issues that are important here and not go into, you know, great, you know, debates about national or international issues.
Right. And because it's the one thing that we can offer. It's what right. we do best. Local news. That's what we're about. And so we do try and keep it to what's going on in our community because we're, you know, the local news is the only place where you can talk about those things.
Well, you know, I'm an old timer, kind of like Howard. I prefer this interactivity. It used to be that you didn't have this ability to help shape the news. You didn't have this ability to interact with the news media. You just pretty much had to just whatever they wrote, whatever they broadcast, that's what you took. But now you have an actual chance to interact, and it's a lot better than it was 30, 40 years ago.
Well,
believe me,
almost. I mean, yeah, that's true. But I mean, I worked for a small town newspaper, you know, back in the late 70s and early 80s. And all I had to do, everybody in town knew who I was, and all I had to do was walk down Main
Street.
That was
your interactivity.
And I'd hear about it. If I wrote something that people didn't like, I'd hear about it. If I wrote something that people were crazy about, I'd hear about that. And that was how you got your feedback.
Howard, how about if we shift this to some politics? I mean, John Kasich had just a really strong finish in New Hampshire this
John
week.
Kasich did have a very good finish with about 16% of the vote in New Hampshire, finished second. He was still Donald Trump had more than twice as many votes as John Kasich did end up with. But Kasich did what he had to do, which was to finish in the top three and enable him to be able to keep going. I mean, he had said it very frankly, you know, in New Hampshire that, you know, if he didn't do well in New Hampshire, then he might as well pack it up and go home.
I was really impressed by the amount of town halls he did there.
Yeah.
The Enquirer is, you know, we have a reporter with Kasich
right.
and following him around to what he's doing. That was a ground game,
like
I feel like I haven't seen.
105 of them.
Yeah, that was a yeah. ground game that was like, I'm going to talk to everyone.
Yeah, and you know what? The thing about that, Sharon, is that, you know, I've covered New Hampshire primary, and New Hampshire is a great place for a reporter to cover because it's small. It's you can drive from one end to the other in, you know, about 2.5 hours. You during primary season, everywhere you turn, you run into a candidate. You know, every little town, people expect to see the candidates. They expect to touch them, to shake their hands, to listen to them. And it's real retail, close to the ground politics.
Well, Ohio is such a big state.
Yeah.
One of the things I've been wondering about is, of course, Kasich seems to have,
yeah.
you know, he'll have the benefit being our governor. But How is it too big of a state for other candidates to get around and do something like that here?
It's much more difficult. I mean, Ohio is more of a state that where it depends on having a whole lot of money to spend on paid media. And, you know, you've got all the, eight media markets in Ohio. Kasich's problem right now is that the upcoming primaries, South Carolina, Nevada, the Super Tuesday primaries on March 1st, which include a lot of very deep South states, that's not his territory. Those Republicans are not the ones who are going to respond to a positive, you know, let's all get together, kumbaya message, which was what John Kasich was doing very effectively up in New Hampshire. New Hampshireites are receptive to that. New Hampshire is an open primary. You don't have to be a Republican to vote in it. And he was getting a lot of independent voters to come over and cast ballots for him because they liked him. Because he wasn't calling people names. He was, you know, the voice of reason. Now he's going to go into a stretch of time where he's going into some more red meat states where they like their red meat and they like, you know, rough and tumble politics.
Right.
And they also some states where there are lots of evangelical Christians who are committed to Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
Some of them still committed to Ben Carson, although he seems to be fading away, but not necessarily in a place like South Carolina.
Do you feel like the win in New Hampshire puts the more national spotlight on Kasich? The Washington Post had a huge story this week about the state of schools.
I know. When I saw that, I said, okay, that was the national news media suddenly waking up and saying, oh, this guy might be president. So then they started looking at his record in Ohio. They were reporting about him talking about his record in Ohio, in New Hampshire. But now they're actually starting to look at it in depth. And some of it is probably not going to be very pretty for him. You know, they were very critical of his record on education.
Well, and I think you can see some other candidates probably making a lot of how he cut all of the local government funds. That has been
exactly.
a big issue that's dogged him throughout that decision.
Right.
And it hurts communities to this day.
Right. And that's one of those things that even with conservative Republicans, you can use that kind of an issue against John Kasich. So, you know, the bigger you get, you know, the more success you have, the bigger the target you are.
I think it's also one of those things that, like, as you move through the process, people start to try to peel back those layers of that onion more and more. The first few stories I saw in the last 3 or 4 weeks on the national media about Kasich were like, this is the guy. Like, he's going to be the nominee because everyone else is
so extreme.
Well,
he got an endorsement from the New York Times.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, as it started to move forward and after New Hampshire, I think now people are going to have to – what's a new story? How do we keep going? And they're going to have to start
looking
at facts more.
Very carefully.
What's he going to do to keep moving forward, Howard? How do you think he keeps moving forward?
Well, I mean, he's got to adjust his message, obviously, you know, to the states that he's running in. You know, he can't reinvent himself again. I mean, you know, he is what he is. In New Hampshire, I was reading all these national profile pieces, you know, in the national news media about John Kasich and, you know, this wonderful miracle of Ohio and what a great campaigner he was and how personable and charming he was. And I'm reading some of these. I'm saying, is this the same guy?
Howard, totally agree.
Is this the same guy that I know or that we know here in Ohio? And, you know, it doesn't match. And it's going to be much more difficult for him as he goes along to kind of separate himself from the actual reality in Ohio as opposed to what he's saying it is on the stump.
Right. And as he gets closer, too, I think all of our Ohio media is going to remind everyone of things that we've been reporting on for years.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I think that was actually the reaction of a number of different journalists, both in our newsroom and elsewhere in the state of Ohio, that I saw on Facebook to that Washington Post story was, hey, by the way, we've been reporting this for years.
Right, This is new. Yeah, this is news to them, but it is not news to us in Ohio.
Will in Cincinnati joins us now. And hi, Will. How you doing?
Well, I'm not doing too good because what I wanted to address is you talked about civility in discussions. And what I'm really grieving is the death of the possibility of having a real true discussion and democratic discussion of either the sewer issue you're talking about or national politics. It's getting worse and worse. So my question to you is, what can you as established media people or online media, the Daily Beast, Huffington Post, or on the other side, or Fox News, MSNBC, what can, the established media that have a little bit of, editorial control, or they have some people above them, do to help promote so that when I go into a Panera and a guy walks up to me and says, Andy says you're blank, the kind of party that I belong to. I don't know who this man is. I smiled at a guy, and he said, well, the man I'm sitting with says you're a blank. And I said, look, I'll have a civil discussion with you about anything, but it's got to be civil if you want to talk about the issues. So this is, for instance, a total stranger, a guy I don't know, walks up to me, and another man I don't know wants to call me out. So I felt like I was like a Jew in the Polish ghetto.
So
I think we're getting that way.
Is your question, Will,
branded with a D for Democrat or R for Republican? And
Will, let me ask you this. So your question actually is, what can the established media do to create more civility? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, can they do anything?
Okay, let us go with that. Thanks,
that
Will.
That includes online media.
What the media can do is not totally eliminate this really mean-spirited nature of politics these days. And I've seen it. I mean, I've covered politics now for over 40 years. And I've seen it change, dramatically over the years and just become more and more mean-spirited and divisive. But we can try to hold them accountable when they are behaving badly. And I think that was one of the problems with the coverage in Iowa and New Hampshire, particularly the national news media, where Donald Trump crossed the line, over and over again in terms of civility. But he would get the network exposure, the national news media exposure, anytime he wanted. No candidate in the history of American politics had gotten as much free media in such a short period of time as Donald Trump.
I've watched it, and I appreciate how difficult their decisions are.
Right.
Because there's so many outlets.
Yeah.
Like, it's hard to ignore something knowing that another outlet could be covering something. And with him, like, for instance, the Huffington Post decided to cover Donald Trump as entertainment. And and you could see why they did that. And that decision made a lot of news. But at the same time, this is very serious. He's a presidential candidate.
Yes.
He's a leading presidential candidate.
He's a leading presidential candidate, but he's not the only presidential candidate.
Yeah.
But he is the only presidential candidate who could call in to, say, the Sunday news talk shows and get on without actually coming to the studio or having a satellite link. I mean, they gave him special privileges.
We're out of time, Howard.
Okay.
All right. Went fast. Yeah. Thanks, everybody, for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
City Hall reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer, Sharon Coolidge. You can follow her reporting at cincinnati.com, WCPO.com, editor-in-chief Mike Cannon, and of course you can read their news coverage at WCPO.com, and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson, and you can keep up with Howard at WVXU.org.